Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today we're going to be discussing the new wave of xenophobic attack against foreign nationals in South Africa. I'm joined by our returning guest, Professor Lauren Landau, a professor of migration and development at the University of Oxford and senior researcher at the University of Witwatersrand in South Africa. Lauren, it's a pleasure to have you join me again, and I look forward to our conversation.
Likewise. I just wish we weren't having to talk about this again.
Yeah, same here, same here. We had the same conversation two years ago, when it's two years or less than two years, we're back again. But I remember what you said the last time. And I wanted us to start from that premise. You said, and I'll quote, you said, when I asked you about the motive for the attack, you said that the attacks or the targets of the attacks, they are not targeting because they are Africans or Asians, but they are seen as outsiders, as other Africans from other communities also outsiders attack. Is that correct with this new wave? Do you still stand on that?
I think at a sort of national or discursive level, there is a language of immigration, and particularly of undocumented, or what people would prefer to say as illegal immigration. Mm-hmm. And that's what we see the discourse. But when you look at who is actually attacked, one, it doesn't matter whether you're legal or not. So you're an asylum seeker, you've got your documents, or you've done everything right. Mm. You're still being attacked. People yesterday were being chased in Durban who are asylum seekers. They're legally in the country. Mm. So the legality doesn't seem to make a difference. But it also, in some ways, doesn't matter exactly if you're immigrant. Some immigrants, they don't care about. Some, they do. It kind of depends on how you're understood. And of course, South Africans are also getting attacked. Even one of them was beat by the police and others the other day because they thought he looked like an immigrant or from someone from another part of the country that they didn't like.
But was that a different thing? That would not be necessarily be targeting South Africans. It would be like mistaken identity.
In that case, but I mean, what we've seen over time is that South Africans are attacked. People may not go out to attack South Africans, but they're attacked because they're not seen as part of the community. You know, that they're from a different province or a different ethnic group, or maybe they're seen as being in alliance with an immigrant, they're married to it, or they've stood up against somebody. But this kind of language of the insider and outsider at the local level is something that it's not a consistent definition. Increasingly at the kind of national level, it's about immigrants, it's about undocumented illegal immigrants. But when it gets down on the ground, yeah, maybe they're going after immigrants, but anyone can get caught up in that mess.
Yes. So everywhere, even here in the UK, we've just had a local election where you see Reform Party and its narrative of we've heard, so many inflammatory statement from some of the Reform candidates and all of that. So we've seen other climates as well. But what is so unique about South Africa? Because South African case there seems to be a violent nature to it, and it seems to be recurrent, and it seems to has its own unique What is unique about the South African case?
Yeah, I mean, this is something we're seeing globally, whether it's the UK, it's the United States, it's Germany, right? It's this kind of a sense among a citizenry, I think, of being lost, of having lost direction and a kind of uncertainty that leads to an existential crisis of like, who are we? What are we even doing here? And who can represent us? And you know, whether it's South Africa or elsewhere, the promises of the past no longer seem to work for people. So across Europe, European Union was supposed to deliver prosperity and security. And while there's not war, people are poor. They're facing inequality. In the United States, people feel that they are slipping, and many people are. In South Africa, people never had much to lose, but they were promised a future, right? So in 1994, with liberation, things were supposed to get better. And sure, violence has gone down. There's not kind of overt civil war. Oppression has gone down. But at a material level, quality is worse. Unemployment is better. But if you thought things were going to improve, you're frustrated. And they've lost faith. So I think part of what's happening is that loss of faith is in the political leadership, the elected leadership. It's in the police, it's in the courts, and they're looking for things and they're trying to find ways of taking control of politics, but also of what's happening around them. And that's where this vigilantism really has the appeal.
So a couple of things you mentioned, so identity matters. So let me speak on the first thing. Who are we? That is a very sociological question to begin with. So I would say, is a question of so in the South African case, you will see other nationalities that are married to South Africans, that have kids to South Africans. So these kids are one parent is a South African, but the other parent is a foreign national, and you have a question, and then you see some of these foreign nationals that have been living here for donkey years. I've got
this. Generations,
so,
even. Yeah.
Generations and all that. So what are we talking about? What is more important? Is it nationality? Is it sovereignty? Is it nation state? What is up? Is there a rupture sociologically? Is that what's going on here?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a really good question of what does it mean to be a South African, right? If you look at the citizenry, it's extraordinarily diverse. You have multiple racial groups. You have a dozen languages that are recognized. You know, this is not a country like France, where it's like to be French means to be, you know, white, Christian, European. South Africa has never been like that, right? And there's a lot of evocation recently of South African values. This is what we believe in. It's not clear that there's much that really binds the South African population. And what I think this is, part of what's going on, is an assertion of what citizenship means to certain people. That it means that you are from here, as they've understood it. They're indigenous, even though, of course, everyone is mixed in one way or another. It means that you believe in certain types of values about community, about maybe about gender, about certain types of things. And others, it's not only that they can't fit, but if they're here, they must adhere to our rules, whatever those are. So in many ways, I see this, even though it's obviously incredibly destructive, this is an effort by many in South Africans to reassert what they think South Africanness should be. And that is increasingly a closed idea. You know, so a couple of years ago, there was this controversy around Miss South Africa competition, where a woman who was, you know, her father was Nigerian, her mother was Mozambican. She grew up in Soweto in South Africa, never lived in any of these other places. She was doing very well in the competition, and there was this gigantic backlash against her because they said she can't be South African. What else is she, right? So it there's all of these questions, and these kind of conversations are not happening in a civilized way. They're being fought out on the street.
I agree with you. And there's something very unique and disturbing at the same time. So you're talking about the loss of faith, fit in the system. You talk about the politics, the quote of that. So is it a question of complicity? Because I was expecting a very strong response. So as I was looking at Cyril Ramaphosa, for instance, in my own opinion, I think it was a tepid response. So I'm looking at that. I'm looking at the police. The police, they look, either you can say they look like incapable, like they can't do nothing, or they look like they're part of the match. So you can't really tell the difference. Mm. So how do you see those responses? Do you think it's a question of complicity, or is it a question of also they understand that they're part of the problem?
Yeah. It's interesting, if we go back to the big attacks that happened in 2008, they got kind of global attention because it was really South Africa, the Rainbow Nation, all of a sudden turning on a group of people within its own borders in a way that was deeply disturbing. And at that time, what you had was, on one hand, complicity of the police, of local leaders, etc. But on the other, you had this widespread condemnation from the political leadership. It was in Thabo Mbeki at the time, a kind of Pan-Africanist response to say, look, we've got problems, but immigrants are not the reason, you know, we shouldn't take this out on immigrants. Mm. In the subsequent almost 20 years, what has happened is that condemnation has dissolved. So that complicity continues. The police are involved. Either they're paid off or they ideologically support the kind of pushing out of people from the communities. It is useful for the police to continue to blame immigrants for crime, because then we don't have to blame ourselves, right? Yeah. It's become increasingly useful for politicians to say it's not corruption, it's not mismanagement, it's not cater deployment, etc. That's the reason you don't have water, electricity, jobs, housing, healthcare, education. It's immigrants. It's become so useful that even on Freedom Day, when President Ramaphosa was, it's a day usually about empowerment, about positive things. At a certain level, he condemned taking the law into your own hands. He condemned the vigilantism, the violence. But preceding that, he was basically, you're right. Immigration is a giant problem. It is one of the major challenges facing South Africa. And as such, just endorsed fully March on March, etc., up to a point. Not to the point where they take the law into their own hands, but ideologically, all of the falsehoods that informed them and informed those movements just got the biggest stamp of approval from the president of the country.
So if we look at the elites now, the politics, and say, yes, they could use this to mask their own failure or shield themselves from being, you know, rightfully criticized. Does it not also reveal the education level of the South African populace? Like, how informed are the populace? Because, you know, this also could be revealing of the kind of educational system in South Africa, or did I have access to be able to understand and decipher and, you know, look at these things themselves. What do you think it speaks to that?
Well, I mean, I do think South Africa has a giant problem with its education system, if you look at the pass rates and mathematics education, etc. But if you look at the rhetoric that people have embraced, the anti-immigrant rhetoric, it has its specificities, but it resonates strongly with what the rhetoric, as you say, we've seen in the United Kingdom, we've seen in Germany, we've seen in the United States, all of which are highly educated countries. It's not, I don't think, about education, maybe about some kind of critical skills, critical independent thinking, but that's not something unique to South Africa. That's a global problem where people, I think, are so lost. They've lost faith in one thing and they're putting their faith in a different kind of rhetoric. And South Africans have struggled for many, many years. They've heard a lot of promises that they no longer believe in. They've decided that this is the promise that they're going to believe in, that if you get rid of immigrants, things are going to get better.
But these immigrants now, you've talked about now, it started from, you know, undocumented or illegal immigrants. Now there is no distinction. These are foreign nationals. But even in that madness, there seems to be some countries that are specifically targeted or specifically, you know, that's getting the bulk of the stuff. Why is this though? There seems to be still some distinction. Why are some countries on the receiving end and others are being fed?
Yeah, I mean, I think on the ground, again, it's not as clean cut as it suggests rhetorically, right? Anyone from somewhere could get caught up. And in many places, you know, people from these countries, the Nigerians, the Zimbabweans, yeah, the others, people ignore them. They live with them peacefully, right? So it's not that everyone is a threat, but I think rhetorically, there are certain countries that are seen as particularly threatening. So the Somalis who come in with the sort of trade and business that seem to come out of nowhere, they're refugees, and yet they seem to be doing well in South Africa as they are in Kenya or Minnesota or whatever. They have a way. And people, I think, feel threatened by that. Obviously, Zimbabweans are a threat just because of the numbers, but also the education, the language, the skills that come in. And I think many South Africans feel that's a direct threat from a kind of job standpoint. Mm-hmm. And then Nigerians who, as you know very well, will globally, their reputation is not savory. Mm-hmm. And so while many Nigerians, of course, are just trading like everybody else or working, and there's a highly educated Nigerian professional class that's also in South Africa, like there are from Kenya and elsewhere. Mm-hmm. But there's the narrative about the Nigerian selling drugs, about the Nigerian doing other things. I think this, particularly in Nigeria, has always rubbed South Africa the wrong way. These are the two giants of the continent, right? They have a friendly rivalry in many things, in football, in music, right? But in business, it's a fierce rivalry. And I think that the Nigeria threatens South Africa in a way that almost no one else can.
But we've also seen what I call retaliatory stance from other African countries, or very strong statement, like from John Mahatma, the president of Ghana. We've seen the president of Botswana, I think, and then Tanzania. They've been. How do you see those kind of responses? Do you think they can be effective, or do you think they're effective in a way?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Whether they're effective or not, I don't think they will be, because the domestic politics right now is so strongly anti-immigrant. There's a local government election happening in November. I can't see any of the political leaders stepping away from this rhetoric. They're in too deep. Will it affect South Africa in the long term? Well, I think it may not affect what they do around immigration, but it's definitely going to hurt South Africa in the long term. We've already seen in the past, you know, Nigeria putting $1 billion fine on MTN, a South African cell phone company, mainly because of how Nigerians were being treated in the country. We've seen other ShopRites and other South African chains being banned or boycotted. And I think we've seen a reluctance across the continent to accept South African investment, political leadership, etc. So in the long term, this will hurt South Africa. The issue is, the politicians are facing a short-term game. They're desperate for votes. They're desperate for credibility. And they may be very willing to trade long-term continental alliances, partnerships, friendships for short-term electoral victories.
That's right. That makes sense. But we've also seen very few. I think one of the strongest voices or responses I've seen at the political level is Julius Malema. The EFF. Do you think that carries any weight?
Well, I mean, it's wonderful to see him speak that way, and a lot of what he says, at least around immigration, makes a lot of sense, right? He's asked people, you burned these shops, you kicked them out of houses, how many more jobs or houses do you have, right? It's an empirical question, and he's absolutely right to show that this has done nothing to help South Africans. But if you look at his poll numbers, they've declined dramatically over the last 10 or 15 years. His kind of populist message has been almost co-opted and stolen by groups like the MK or some of the other more populist parties. He's, of course, now been convicted of illegally firing a gun, and his political future is uncertain. Does he represent a strain of South African thinking? I think he does, absolutely. But it's a voice and a perspective that is increasingly marginalized.
But there's them. There's another aspect as well, like the leaders of the March and March. There is, I don't know if this is in the realm of conspiracy theory. There's also a mixture of personal vendetta or personal experiences of that they've experienced that is fueling this kind of like match and match, this hate and violence that is beyond, you know, the unemployment, the general that is adding fuel to it. How true is that?
I don't know about the personal level. I'm sure on the ground, when people are marching, if you attack a shop, you attack somebody, there may be personal motivations. I think when we look at something like March on March or Dudula, the Operation Dudula, or any of the other groups, there was the South African Truckers Association, I think, that was a couple of years ago, was burning trucks on the highway that were ostensibly driven by foreigners. These groups have interests, and often those interests are personal. So March on March, the leader is married to a Zuma, you know, is clearly closely connected to MK politics in KwaZulu-Natal. And they have an objective to try to drum up support, to try to ensure that their members have access to tenders or houses or resources. They want to get rid of competition. They want to win power in the unions or wherever else it might be. So those may be personal vendettas, and we might say that Jacob Zuma has a personal vendetta because of the way he was marginalized from the ANC, et cetera. And this might be their way back into politics. So I think we're definitely seeing that at the political level. And then on the ground, it's very hard to know. There will be people who get attacked because of someone wants that shop gone, or they want that person gone because they represent a competition for a woman, competition for a job, competition for a business, who knows? But I think the real story here is about political competition.
Yeah, very interesting. But another thing he also speaks to is, at the broader level, migration. Whether be it forced migration, where people, you know, in Africa, there's so many conflict, there's conflict in Sudan, there's conflict everywhere, where people are forced to migrate out of. But there's also genuine migration, where people just want to migrate, professionals want to migrate to come to, you know, we go, I know a lot of colleagues that are professionals in South Africa. So how does this affect or speak to that broader sense of mind? Because people have been migrating, since migration is as old as time. So how does that, because again, we're looking at Trump, with you know, Trump having at that level, like, but now Trump is opening up to migrants from Africa, that in where they got shortage in the medical field. So you look at, how long can we play this migration politics?
Yeah.
When migration is very, very, so what I'm saying is, migration has always been as old as time. So how does this affect that concept? Are people going to be more close? Is this going to affect migration patterns? What's going to happen in the long run?
Yeah, I mean, I think if we look at, obviously, migration is as old as time, and South Africa has been shaped by migration, you know, first of the sort of Bantu migrations coming in from Central and West Africa, European migration, indentured labor from South Asia, then, of course, people being expelled either by Shaka Zulu, you know, and others. Migration displacement has shaped the whole region, let alone the migration labor system under apartheid, which brought, you know, millions of people in from Mozambique, Lesotho, Swaziland, Rhodesia at the time, Zimbabwe later, Malawi. And that has shaped what South Africa is. That's shaped what it looks like, the kind of profile of the people who are there. It's also not going to stop because the whole region has been shaped by these migrations. Zimbabwe, Mozambique, etc. These economies are inseparable from South Africa. Because in part, because people have moved back and forth over the last 100, 200 years to work in the countries. So it's not going to stop. And that if we were able to have a sort of sensible discussion around migration, we'd realize that for the most part, it shouldn't stop, because this kind of migration promotes trade, it promotes integration, it promotes the kind of goodwill that's necessary for a dynamic regional economy, which is stronger for the you know, for South Africa and will ultimately create jobs in the long term. Instead, South Africa, like the United States, like England, somehow wants to separate itself from these thousands of years of history and hundreds of years of migration, integration, with this idea that we can do it better ourselves. You know, I'm joining you now from the UK, and it's obvious the UK is suffering from that policy. It's suffering from having disconnected itself from the world. And I think we will start to see this in South Africa. It will suffer, not just skills, but trade, goodwill, the ability of South Africa to shape politics around it. We're too late in our existence as a species to say that we can live on our own as one country disconnected. And that's what this kind of immigration debate, I think, is trying to achieve.
So this is that, exactly. This is where I look at this level of retrogression. I wonder how a country can be self-sufficient on its own. It's very impossible because, and I heard this, I don't know how true it is. They were saying, was in Mozambique. Mozambique, part of the retaliatory step was to cut off, was it supply of electricity or supply of some stuff to South Africa and stuff like that. But the question I was going to ask is, you mentioned the economy, for instance. So that's the elephant in the room. So we know since 1994, South Africa has not experienced economic freedom.
Yeah.
And even the political freedom, I might say to some extent, it's one that is just elite-based. What is happening in that aspect? And why is it that South Africa has not faced that conversation or tried to deal with it decisively? Like, look at, to create more kind of like economic justice, if we would say, to its underprivileged or majority Black population.
Yeah, I'm not an economist, and I can't pretend to fully understand the South African economy. But what I can say is that many of the ambitions post 94 were obviously valuable, about jobs, about equality, about access to services. Those were deeply humane, and I think absolutely what was owed to the South African population, who had been deprived, violently deprived from dignity and services and freedom for generations. Some of those policies, of course, were misguided in the sense that, you know, how they tried to provide housing, the way in which they imagined the state was going to create jobs. But some of them were also misguided in the sense that they didn't have the expertise or the knowledge. So a lot of urban planning totally misestimated how many South Africans would move to the cities. So they completely, you know, the investment in infrastructure, the investment in water, et cetera, in housing, just wasn't there. And that's part of why we have, you know, sprawling townships with massive competition for scarce resources. But even with that, I think the kind of the way in which all of this was implemented, the way in which the ruling party, the ANC at the time, tried to colonize the state, tried to ensure that the state served the party first and the country second, the way in which the ANC was then colonized by individuals who wanted the party to serve them and then the party and then maybe at some point down the road, the people, right? These things, the impacts of this can't be overestimated. I think if you didn't have that kind of capture and corruption, people would be seeing progress. We would still be in a situation where not every South African had a job or a house or the education we'd want, but we would be seeing improvements, and that would keep a faith in the system. But now we seem to be seeing things going backwards. And that's part of where the anxiety, the deep anxiety, comes from.
So in the times of, let's say, the South African state seems to be complicit or seems not to protect our nationals, and things get out of hand. We've seen the United Nations, I think the General Secretary, you know, response. We've seen the African Union and stuff. Do you think there might be, we've seen other nationalities will try to
evacuate their people.
So do you think, what I'm saying, do you think this could, with the way it's going, do you think there could be a case of genocide intent where there might be some sort of intervention where the South African government might be seen as either weak or either complicit, where it might then necessitate some form of intervention or response? I don't know. Do you think that is a possibility?
I mean, genocide from a legal standpoint, as we've seen with Gaza and others, has a, you know, a very specific definition and a reluctance among many people to use that language. But what we've obviously seen in places, going back, I personally saw in Motherwell outside of PE in 2007, what is effectively forms of ethnic cleansing, where you have state complicity with others going through neighborhoods, trying to remove, not necessarily kill, but remove people because they belong to a certain ethnic group or nationality. And that's definitely counts as a crime against humanity. And to the degree that the state is seen as instigating it, or is seen as encouraging it or complicit in it, then I think there is a case against them. I think it's very unlikely. If we can't see people intervening in Sudan, we can't see people intervening in Gaza, that kind of overt intervention in South Africa seems extremely unlikely. And fortunately, South Africa's, the scale of the problem is nothing like those others.
I'm glad you see
a kind of condemnation. Mm-hmm. And I think we're seeing that from across the African continent, a condemnation of South Africa and its political, social direction. Mm-hmm. And I think hopefully, at some point, we will see a condemnation of the vigilante groups who've decided to not only to take the law into their own hands, but to decide who has a right to live in South Africa or in their communities. At some point, I hope they will be held to account for the violence that they do and the hate that they've propagated. But I think if the past is anything to go on, those responses so far will not have much effect and they'll be quite weak.
I agree. I think we and also does that not speak also to the vacuum of leadership? I mean, global governance now, where there seems to be where the usual people that govern at the global level have lost that moral compass. We're talking about the United States, talking about all of that. Could we look at that as also emboldening the marches and emboldening all of these people from these other places that are taking all of this law into their hands? Because who's going to condemn? What right do you have to condemn?
Yeah, I think we see this across multiple scales. So in the past, as we've been discussing, the South African politicians, most of them would have condemned this kind of speech. Now they're the ones propagating it. They're the ones leading it. And they do so in a way, in a kind of dialogue with what's happening in Europe, the United States, Australia, elsewhere, where, you know, Europe will look to South Africa and be like, look, African migration is a problem. Even other Africans are saying it's a problem, right? So it emboldens them and they use it to try to legitimize their own kind of concerns with people coming across the Mediterranean. Donald Trump doesn't really even know where South Africa is, I think. So it's, you know, he's not paying that much attention. But clearly the United States stepping out of that space, of that kind of moral leadership, of that kind of commitment to equality and rights, and making funding and trade dependent on that, and open space across Africa for these kind of movements. And I think it does suggest that whether it's in South Africa or anywhere else in the world, that we may be in for quite a dark time, because there is not a voice, there does not seem to be widespread popular opinion in favor of a more inclusive, cosmopolitan hybrid identity, even though that is increasingly the norm across much of the world, de facto.
You know, another important thing is this. You mentioned it, but we've seen it. We saw in the Sahel where there is a genuine citizen protest. We see Africa has the youngest youth population. And these people are far removed from that colonial narrative, whether from that apartheid narrative. They don't even understand, let's say in the South African case, they don't understand the role other African nation played in the fight against apartheid. So they are far removed from that. They're looking at bread and butter. We're dealing, we don't have work, we don't have food. And the fight we saw in Mozambique the last time, we see in Kenya. So we're seeing the rise of some sort of political consciousness, but again, it's not one that is intellectually guided, intellectually. So one question is this: is citizen response the way to go? Is that a new direction? Number one, and two, why is there the absence of an intellectual response that we see in the response to, let's say, colonialism or to apartheid? These were very intellectually driven response that were guided, not in this kind of way. Why? So those are like two questions.
Yeah, I mean, I do think what we're seeing across a lot of Africa and maybe elsewhere in the world is as the sort of the old systems break down, especially most recently the United States, of course, pulling out of aid and investment. But even some of the Europeans, we've seen, you know, in West Africa, a very strong response against France, for example. And we're seeing a kind of political realignment. That political realignment is not necessarily the kind of liberation that was imagined by the leaders in the 40s and 50s. We're seeing the rise of organizations like Boko Haram or ISIS. We're seeing the rise of groups like March on March in South Africa, or the rise of authoritarianism in East Africa. Right? We're also seeing the rise of not just millenarian Islam, but millenarian and kind of Pentecostal Christianity, all of which are providing a different kind of order. I think that what is important in many of those cases, not all but many, is that they are being organized outside of the state. So whereas the liberation movements of the past were about creating post-colonial states and systems and nations, these are working in a different sort of register of informality, of spirituality, of not of law, but of a different kind of order. And in some sense, I think those are being intellectually led. You know, if you look at the religious movements, they have an ideology. It's just maybe not one that we're comfortable with. If you look at a March on March, they have an ideology. It's increasingly sophisticated. It's increasingly thought out. Again, I wouldn't call it liberation for me. It wouldn't be the version of liberation I would like to see. But I think for those who are attracted to it, especially with groups like March on March in South Africa, they see this as a way to promote their freedom, their rights, to get justice where the state and others have failed them. Hopefully, this doesn't lead to sort of mass violence, conflict, etc. We're already seeing in places like West Africa, we're seeing this in Mali now. It does. But I think, yeah, these movements have captured people and their realities in a way that these maybe more intellectual movements, the Fanons and the Senghors and the others, those no longer resonate in quite the same way.
Yeah, I agree. Let's come to the last question. What do you think is going to happen with these current wave in the short term? What do you think is going to happen? Then in the long term, we kind of like can predict, because this is, we see a kind of pattern. 2008, there's another 2011-12, there's one 2021. There seems to be some kind of like consistency with that. But in the short term, at least, what do you think is going to happen with this current wave?
I think in South Africa, the
I'm sorry to add to that. And what should happen?
Well, what should happen, of course, is they should be finding ways to stop it, and that would be holding the leaders of those movements accountable and investigating and addressing those who've instigated it. But I think that's quite unlikely to happen, because almost everybody is complicit in this movement in one way or another. This is the first election and the national election that will follow in a few years where South African politics are really up for grabs, right? And people are struggling to find ways of garnering support. I think until this next election, immigration, this kind of mobilization will be a major part of South Africa's political landscape. Over time, it's not going to work. It won't deliver. And over time, the empowerment of these kind of vigilante groups, these groups that work outside of the law, that claim local political authority through violence, ultimately will weaken the South African state and its ability to deliver for its citizens. But in the short term, it might deliver people office. And so I expect, unless politics shifts, unless somehow the courts really stand up and start holding people accountable, we're going to see more of this violence. It will become more institutionalized, more normalized. It will become more, less from the margins and more in the mainstream. But based on what we've seen, there's no reason to believe it's going anywhere.
I agree with you. Well, on that note, I'll say, Lauren, Professor Landau, it's been a great pleasure to have you again. As usual, always enjoy our conversation and enjoy and appreciate your insights into this current wave. And I
really thank you for the invitation and the conversation.
You're welcome. Thank you very much. Thank you for tuning in to today's episode on the current wave of xenophobic attack in South Africa. As usual, join me to thank our returning guest, Professor Lauren Landau. And for now, stay blessed and I'll see you next week.